This is the Berkeley Signal.
Democratic Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey is calling on the FBI and Department of Homeland Security to investigate whether employees at Trump National Golf Club broke the law by helping undocumented employees obtain fake work papers. On Monday, Senator Menendez called on the federal government to allow former undocumented employees of the Trump properties to remain in the country while the investigation proceeds. This comes amid news reports that the Trump company has fired at least 18 undocumented workers from five golf courses in New York and New Jersey in the past 2 months, part of a purge set in motion after a series of reports about the club's employment of workers without legal status.
In December, an undocumented housekeeper from Guatemala named Victorina Morales helped expose what was happening on the Trump properties by speaking on record to the New York Times. Morales spent years making Trump's bed and performing other duties at his New Jersey club, even though she was undocumented. Well, on Tuesday, Morales had a chance to see her former boss in person when she attended the State of the Union, where Trump railed against undocumented immigrants, claiming, quote, large organized caravans are on the march to the United States, unquote, and incorrectly suggested undocumented immigrants threaten the economic well-being of other Americans. Victorina Morales attended the State of the Union as a guest of New Jersey Democratic Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman. I spoke to both of them on Wednesday. I began by asking Congresswoman Watson Coleman why she brought Victorina to the State of the Union.
Number one is she really is the honest face of immigrants. She's a hardworking, trustworthy, just wanting a better life for her family, not causing any trouble, paying her taxes, becoming a part of a community, and just doing her job. This is the real face, I believe, of immigrants seeking a better way of life here in the United States of America. Contrasting that to what the president has said, that we should fear illegal immigration, situation that we needed to build a wall to keep them out, to keep us safe, laid upon lies as to who they are and what they are. And it shows the hypocrisy of Donald Trump, the president, and Donald Trump, the entrepreneur. Because the entrepreneur not only hired undocumented immigrants, his organization found them documents that would be used to put into their file so that they could work there. And it wasn't until after he became the nominee for president that they decided that the documents that they'd already had on behalf of these workers wasn't sufficient. So they arranged for them to get even new fraudulent documents that would look better, but were still fraudulent. And so he had this environment where he hired illegal immigrants. He gave them no benefits. He did not pay them good salaries. And the environment there was so hostile that when they complained about anything, they were basically told to shut up or you'll get into trouble. So it just documents the hypocrisy of the Donald Trump that's president and the Donald Trump that still holds his interests in his businesses.
Victorina Morales, what was it like to be sitting there last night at the State of the Union address, seeing your former boss, President Trump, talking about undocumented immigrants?
He's a total hypocrite. It's a hypocrisy because he always talks badly about immigrants. We accept that he is a horrible person. He's very aggressive concerning us. And I ask God that at least the Congress people listen to us. We are raising our voice. I thank them for that. In this country, there are many good people. There are many people who love us. There are many people who are helping us.
Can you tell us your story, Victorina? Tell us how you came to work at the Bedminster golf course of President Trump to clean his room, to make his bed.
I came in 2013 to work in that place. At the beginning, when he was not president, we saw him as a good person. He even tipped me three times. And I made his bed. I cleaned up his hotels. I made the bed of the first lady and Barron's bed. I cleaned Ivanka's house. And when he became president, that's when I saw his second face. He's a hypocrite because there we discovered his second face. He started talking badly about immigrants. That's why I'm here showing my face, because he says that we're liars, that we're rapists, thieves. And if it had been the case, I wouldn't be here. I worked for him for 5 years, and he doesn't value the work of immigrants.
So talk about your decision, Victorina, in December to come forward to the New York Times.
The decision is that I got tired of abuse, including there was a supervisor there who called us stupid, said that we were donkeys. She compared me with her dog. She said that her dog understood better English than we did. Three times they pushed me. They were trying to hit me. And that's why I said, no, I've had enough. So I raised my voice, my lawyer heard me, and now you're listening to me. My voice is being extended. Thank you for listening to me. I'm an immigrant. I am undocumented. I'm very poor.
Victorina, can you describe what the working conditions were like at the Bedminster Golf Club before Trump ran for president and then when he was running, as well as the time he was president? Did they change?
When he became president, that's when I saw that supervisors, we saw how he was talking about us on TV. And that's why I thought that the supervisors there started treating us badly. They called us stupid immigrants. They were using the same words he was using. They didn't have the education to treat us well, to respect us. He doesn't even respect himself. And of course, he doesn't respect us, immigrants. So, but thank you.
Eric Trump, President Trump's son, are you contending that it was the Trump organization that helped you to falsify papers?
Yes, of course. The supervisor helped me. He told me that I had to do the papers over again, that I had to make a new ID in order to be able to keep working there. When his cousin took me to a place near Bamberg, and they made my false papers there. The supervisor took the picture, and he asked me for $175. And he told me, when he gave me the document, hide them, because if the police sees them, they can arrest you. This is the truth. This is what happened. We cannot go on lying. They say that we're lying, that we're thieves, rapists. But no, we're here to work. They know that because we were their employees. And that's why I don't tire myself of saying that they are hypocrites, that they are lying. They are the liars.
How many people would you estimate at Bedminster were undocumented?
When the news came out in December, I stopped going to work because I was the one who gave those news. I was tired of being abused. I said, enough of listening to him on the TV. See how he treats us as migrants. I said, no, I'm going to speak out. I'm going to come forward and I'm going to say that he's a liar. And that's why I'm here, showing my face so that he sees that we're not liars. I am saying the truth.
Did you receive a certificate from the White House for doing outstanding work for the president, cleaning his room?
Yes, I have the certificate. It's a document they gave me for having done the best work at the golf club of the president. Yes, I got that certificate.
You heard Trump talking about invaders coming in from over the border and his demand to build a wall over the border. What are your thoughts?
Yes, what I think is that he should stop talking about the wall and that people come forward, because there are many people working for him. He has five clubs and they are undocumented.
And what do you think about Eric Trump saying, you know, some people just don't have papers and this happens in an organization that has thousands of workers? How high up do you think the knowledge of your not having documents and others not having documents went in Bedminster?
That information went very high because many people are coming forward. I was undocumented and I was working there. And now there are many people who are being fired who were undocumented and who were working for him, because there are five clubs who have been firing people.
Can you talk about when you came to the United States and why you left Guatemala and how you made your way here?
I came in 1999 from Guatemala. I was with my parents there. I was 7 years old when my father got killed. And then I got married. My husband came in 1999 to this country. And a year after he was here, he sent for me. After we sent money, we made a house. Then they killed my father-in-law in front of my children. But when I came to this country, it was 1999. I started working in Bedminster for the president till now in 2013, till 2018, when I raised my voice because I got tired.
So I wanted to turn back to Bonnie Watson Coleman, the congressmember from New Jersey who invited Victorino Morales to the State of the Union address. As you listen to Victorino's story, one that you know well now, what are you calling for? Fellow New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez says that they will launch an investigation into the Trump Organization's employment practices. What are you doing in the House?
Well, first of all, we have the same letter to the FBI seeking the same investigation, because there are many employment violations and other hostile work environment situations, other illegal situations regarding the procuring of fraudulent documents. Victorina right now is an applicant for asylum. So she's also a material witness, and we think that those issues will protect her from being deported or detained or anything of that nature. This is not an isolated incident in the Trump enterprises. They knew what they were doing. They facilitated people getting fraudulent documents to put in the file. So it doesn't matter what an Eric Trump or anybody else says right now. They very well knew, and they are lying if they're suggesting in any other way. There are more than 20 people who've already been identified in the same situation as Victorina, and there are probably many more, my understanding, to be identified. This is a pattern and practice of illegal employment activity, of creating creating a hostile work environment. But even more than that, this is an illustration of using good, decent, hardworking, honest people as pawns for a wall on the border that will serve no good interests, no service interests. And this is a justification for having shut down government for 5 weeks and deprived 800,000 people of their paychecks. This is just an illustration of the corrupt environment in which this administration is functioning.
We're joined now by Anibal Romero, an immigration attorney representing a number of undocumented workers at the Trump National Golf Course, including Victorina Morales. Welcome to Democracy
Thank
Now.
Thank you. Thank you
so
for having me.
So what happens now, and what are you doing?
Sure. So we have been in contact with the FBI. We have been in contact with New Jersey Attorney General's office and New York State Authority. They're also contacting me. I now represent 25 ex-employees of the Trump National Golf Club in four different cities. It's my understanding that employees at five golf clubs have been let go. And there's a difference between permanent employees and temporary employees. The golf season ends in November. And it's my understanding that many employees who are undocumented will not be returning to work next year. At each golf club, approximately half of the staff was undocumented. And most of the people I have spoken to, I have 25 clients, but I've spoken to more than 30, say basically the way you get the job there is by someone brings you in and you're told to go purchase fraudulent documents. In some cases, they were told that if they didn't find someone, they would help them find that person to buy these fraudulent documents. And then you started working there. And this isn't something that started a couple of days ago. I've seen pay stubs as far as 2001. Many of these employees were the most trusted employees of the Trump family. Victorina Morales worked directly for the president and for Ms. Ivanka Trump. In the case of two other employees, one in Hudson Valley, apparently he worked directly for Mr. Eric Trump. And I have another employee in Westchester who also had the keys to Mr. Eric Trump's house. These people had been there for over 15, 16, 17 years. And during the government shutdown, they decide to let them go because Victorina Morales spoke in December.
Can these people be deported?
Technically, yes. However, at this point, what we are saying is that anyone who has worked for the Trump Organization as an undocumented immigrant is a material witness of a federal conspiracy, a multi-state federal conspiracy. And any attempt to try to remove them from the United States could be obstruction of justice.
What do you say to, Eric Trump and others who've denied any knowledge? They say they don't know that they were undocumented. Why did they get them papers? Because there are a lot of undocumented people who work without having fake work papers. Why did the Trump Organization do that?
Sure. So what I would say is that my clients are saying that supervisors knew, managers knew, the general managers knew. Now, whether President Trump himself knew or Eric Trump knew, I'm not sure. I'm assuming that investigators can ask questions and we will get to the bottom of this. And why they were asking for documents, I'm not sure. I know there are a lot of undocumented immigrants who earn cash. In this case, I've seen business records. I've seen W-2s. And here's something important. When you look at these pay stubs, none of the undocumented immigrants had health insurance. And according to what they are saying is that health insurance was offered to other employees who were American citizens or legal permanent residents. And I asked a question. If none of the undocumented immigrants had health insurance or a 401k plan, why? Because they knew that they were undocumented and undocumented immigrants are not eligible for health insurance.
And they're much more vulnerable to threats. As Victorina said, she would be threatened with deportation.
Yes. For years, she was told that she could be deported if she spoke out. And on the number of occasions, she was physically assaulted. My other client, Sandra Diaz, saw how other housekeepers were assaulted. They took this up to the general manager and they decided to do nothing. And they would always say, well, this is a private golf club. No one's going to come in. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be okay.
Victorina's applying for asylum?
Yes, she has a very compelling asylum case. We are waiting for a hearing and we expect that she will be granted asylum. And in 1 year, she will be a legal permanent resident. But there are 23 other clients who at this point are vulnerable. And they are telling me that the temporary employees are terrified that they could get deported. They're talking about numbers in the hundreds.
And your response to Eric Trump saying, we have thousands and thousands of workers. We can't know this stuff.
Sure. Well, no, that's not the case at the golf club. The golf club roughly has about 100 employees. And what the workers are telling me, half of them were undocumented in Westchester. And I would say the same for Bedminster. I understand the organization might have thousands, but the golf clubs themselves, each one of them that operates independently, has roughly about 100 employees. So we're talking about 500 employees in five golf clubs. Half of them are undocumented, possibly, according to what clients are telling me. And we haven't heard from other golf clubs in other parts of the United States.
Congress is doing an investigation?
Yes. We were there last week. We met with members of the House. We met with Senator Booker from New Jersey and also Senator Menendez. I believe they are circulating a letter requesting not only a thorough investigation by the FBI, Homeland Security Investigations, but also protections for these workers.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Social media giant Facebook has had its fair share of criticism, from the role it played in fomenting, polarizing, and fake news ahead of the 2016 election, to the ways in which it keeps tabs on users and scoops up personal data. But that criticism appears to be warranted, even after Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg penned an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal to try to defend his practices. In his piece, titled The Facts About Facebook, Zuckerberg wrote, "We need your information for operation and security, but you control whether we use it for advertising." Critics jumped to debunk his claims, even as a new report emerged about a disturbing app that the company launched to pay teenagers to spy on them. My guest is Mara Einstein. She is a professor and chair of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York and an independent marketing consultant. Welcome to the program, Mara. What do you first make of this op-ed that Zuckerberg wrote? I think the fact that he felt he had to write it shows that this is a company under major scrutiny. He's obviously a PR effort, but he claimed this was just him listing facts about Facebook. To me, it seemed more like Zuckerberg's version of the facts.
Absolutely. This is a conversation that he's been having actually over and over again, or as PR people have been sort of forcing him to have over and over again. And it reminds me an awful lot of the time when he was called in front of Congress to talk about what was going on with Facebook. And every time he sort of dodged the facts a little bit or twisted them just enough to feel like they were innocuous, and they're not. And one of the biggest things, it appears both in his testimony as well as in this op-ed that he wrote, which is, we don't sell your data, right? And I think for consumers, that's been the bugaboo. Companies are scooping up our data and they're selling it. And so somebody said to Zuckerberg somewhere, if you tell them we're not selling your data, then consumers will feel okay about it. The problem with that is, no, they're not selling your data, but they are using the data to then sell advertising to companies in order to be able to target you. So in essence, the same thing happens. They just don't directly sell your information. And the same thing is true with Google. Google doesn't sell your information. Google gobbles it up and keeps it for themselves. And that's exactly what Facebook is doing.
Right. We have to keep reminding ourselves, in the age of the internet, personal information is the currency, is the product that they are trading. So Zuckerberg said in his Wall Street Journal op-ed, people consistently tell us that if they're going to see ads, they want them to be relevant. That means we need to understand their interests. The New York Times had an op-ed in response called Mark Zuckerberg's Delusion of Consumer Consent, where they say that they did studies showing that a majority of internet users do not want tailored ads for products and services. How important is this one point? Because Zuckerberg is basically saying, we're just giving people what they say they're okay with.
There's one aspect of that he avoids or tiptoes around, which is the fact that people don't want advertising at all.
Right.
And we know this because look at how many people have used ad blockers, how many people have done everything they can to actually avoid advertising. That's why marketers and publishers have become more and more surreptitious in terms of the way that they advertise to consumers, because consumers don't want to interact with it to begin with. So, yeah, if you're going to get an ad, yes, you probably do want something that is more tailored to what your needs and cares are. But the fact of the matter is that the algorithms still aren't good enough to actually do that. So, you know, I think that most people in your audience would be able to relate to the fact that they bought a pair of shoes or they were planning a vacation. And if they ended up not buying it, that it still followed them around the internet. Or even if they finally booked the vacation, it kept following them around the internet. Well, that's because the technology is still not there to be able to understand who we are, exactly what we want, and how we want to be targeted to. So he can make the argument that the ads are better tailored, and maybe they are better tailored, but it doesn't mean that they're good. And that's part of the argument that he doesn't want to discuss.
There was a terrible story late last year about a woman who was pregnant and she had a stillborn child. So her baby died and social media still kept targeting her with baby ads. So she shared her story about it. And, you know, in a way that was re-traumatizing her, of course, that these social media companies just fail on. The other thing that Zuckerberg said in his Wall Street Journal article was, on Facebook, Facebook, you have control over what information we use to show you ads, and you can block any advertiser from reaching you. You can find out why you're seeing an ad and change your preferences to get ads you're interested in. And you can use our transparency tools to see every different ad an advertiser is showing to anyone else. And then ProPublica, just the same week, days after he wrote this op-ed, said Facebook quietly blocked tools that let people see how its ads are targeted.
Kara Swisher, who has a podcast, Recode, and writes on technology, she rewrote Mark Zuckerberg's op-ed. And one of the things she wrote in there, which was absolutely spot on, was that people don't understand how this technology works because it is difficult. I mean, you really have to look to find these things and to be able to make sure that the advertising is the way you want it to be. But she compared it to having the 12 o'clock flashing on your VCR, right? Because nobody could ever figure out how to set the clock on their VCR. And that actually wasn't all that difficult. This is much more complex. And if you really ask people, you know, can you go in and change the readings and so on, most people would say, I had no idea I would be able to do that. And they don't. Two of the ways I like to think about this, too, is somebody just told me about, and maybe some of your listeners and viewers know about this, there's something going on at Instagram and Facebook now to put a picture of yourself from 10 years ago and a picture of yourself now right next to each other. And there's some speculation that Facebook is using this as facial recognition to be able to see how people have aged over time, and so they can use it to improve their facial recognition technology. And Facebook is saying, no, we didn't create this meme. This is a meme that was created by somebody else. And that's fine, but Facebook will still get the value from having those progressions next to each other. And sure, they could go back in and try and find your picture from 10 years ago, but it's a whole lot easier if people are competing against each other and putting their pictures from 10 years ago and now right next to each other. Now, people are doing this because they think it's a game. But the fact of the matter is, it becomes a really clever way for Facebook to use that information to improve their technologies. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is, I think that people have a very good sense that their data is being collected by these companies, but I don't think that people have a full sense of the consequences of it. You know, a place where I see that is in my classroom. So I will say to my students, do you have a good sense of how much information is being accumulated about you? And they'll say, yeah, we know. And they're like, well, do you care about it? And they'll say, no, you know, it's really fine. And then they'll say, okay, well, let me rephrase that question. What if I told you you couldn't get health insurance because of what these companies see about you? Or what if I said that you couldn't get a mortgage because of what these people collect about you? Or what if I said you couldn't get a job because of it, but you don't know that that's the reason why you're not getting a job? The response usually is, well, we know how to do the privacy information and all of that kind of stuff. I'm like, don't kid yourself, because companies have found ways to work around that. And it's not just companies, it's also universities are starting to look at people's social media. And what the smart students have done is changed their name on social media so it's not actually a name. So yeah, everybody's using this. And we don't know how, not just Facebook, but all these other institutions, how this information is being used against us. The issue with this, Sonali, is that Facebook doesn't have a motivation to not do this.
Yeah.
They don't have any sort of motivation to not do something that will get more people onto their site so that they can sell more advertising, because their whole revenue model is based on an ad model. So the more they can serve up ads that are going to help advertisers, the more they're going to do that. So they have no motivation at all not to gobble up our data, not to take more and more information about us so that they can serve it back to advertisers. And one of the things, too, that I thought was very disingenuous in Zuckerberg's op-ed was he was talking about how many small businesses are able to use Facebook as a platform through which to sell their products. Yeah, sure, but it's not free to them. And what Facebook has done with the algorithms is make sure that people's information, particularly businesses, is not going to be pushed through the system without them paying for advertising to do it.
The Center for Investigative Reporting put out a week before Mark Zuckerberg's op-ed. And I don't know if you saw this, Mara, but it was basically this report that relied on internal documentation that they obtained from Facebook showing that Facebook employees routinely encouraged game developers to let children spend their parents' money through playing games on their Facebook page. Games like Angry Birds, Petville, and Ninja Saga. Sometimes the children didn't even know they were spending money. And Facebook called it friendly fraud in an effort to maximize revenues. No one's even talking about this. It came a week ago, and you know it's already lost in the mess of things that Facebook does.
If we go back to thinking about Cambridge Analytica, how did Cambridge Analytica get all of the information from, what, 70 million people? And that was through apps, right? And so I think if people are still on Facebook, which I don't think they should be, but if you're still on Facebook, don't put games or apps that you do through Facebook. I used to play Scrabble with my husband through Facebook, and we stopped doing that because if somebody's going to get into Facebook and to tap into our data, this is going to be the way that they're going to do it. The other thing, too, is to not go through Facebook through an app, but do it on your laptop. Don't do it on your phone.
Because it's more vulnerable to sucking up data through the phone.
Yes, and if people want to read a book, there's a book called Anti-Social Media, which is all about Facebook and all of their wrongdoings. The fact that they sold ads to Russians and knew that they were doing this, right? That there's no stop gaps on that. When I talk to new sort of social media folks, and they always look at me and they're like, oh, you're an old-time marketer. And I'm like, yeah, I am an old-time marketer. And part of what I talk about as it relates to that, and I talk about this in Black Ops, is that when I worked in advertising, and if I was going to put a commercial on a broadcast network, we had to show the script to the broadcast networks before we produced the commercial. And they would say to us, you know what, the content in this commercial is not something that we can put on our air. So there were gatekeepers along the way. But what's happening in the current advertising space, in the social media space, is that there isn't anybody looking at the advertising. There are, you know, some people that are looking at some of the content and pulling some of the content down, saying it's objectionable content, but there aren't the kind of stop gaps on the advertising to say that this is acceptable or not acceptable. And they're saying that AI is good enough to do it, and I say it's not. You need real humans with real brains in their heads. They're going to look at this content and understand it within the context within which it is being presented to be able to say, no, this is not acceptable advertising.
Mara, what do you make of the fact that Facebook has just hired one of its biggest critics, Nate Cardozo of the Electronic Frontier Foundation? He was an attorney there. He'd been critical for years of Facebook. He once even said, Facebook depends on our collective confusion. They've now hired him.
The most recent thing that I read was about how Facebook is planning to integrate WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook. So it makes me think that maybe what he's going to do is find a way to do it so they can try and circumvent being regulated. All of this is all about, let us never forget that Facebook is a private company that has no regulations on it at all. And that 60% of the company is owned by Mark Zuckerberg. And so till you can change that part of the equation, and the only part of that equation we can change is the regulatory part of it. We have no control over what happens in that space. So if you're okay with that, great, go play there. But if you're not, be aware of the fact that he can do whatever he wants with your information, whether he's hired this new guy or not. I'm really mixed about that. I mean, the only thing I can think of is either he's trying to do it in such a way to integrate WhatsApp so as to be able to find a way to circumvent the rancor of regulators. Because look, he went and presented to Congress, and everybody's so worried about Trump and everything else that Facebook has sort of fallen off the map. And it's time for them and Google and Amazon and Apple to all get brought in front of the Senate, in front of the House, and people need to talk about how to regulate these institutions.
A huge part of the problem is that the technology has changed faster than the regulations have had a chance to keep up with them. But the other part of that is that most of our lawmakers, as they demonstrated during the hearing where Zuckerberg was asked to testify last year, simply don't understand Facebook and social media well enough to know how to regulate it. I mean, we don't understand it. Our members of Congress, most of whom have an average age older than the average Facebook user likely, or Twitter or Instagram user, they have no idea how it works and they don't know in turn how to regulate it. And it seems as though Congress needs to rely on some privacy experts, groups like Electronic Frontier Foundation and others, to give them some guidance on how best to regulate Facebook. Facebook, right?
Out of my own pocket, I sent a copy of Black Ops Advertising to every senator. My favorite story about that is Orrin Hatch thanked me for the book about poetry. So I know they didn't read it. And I didn't necessarily expect that the senators would read it, but I would hope that some of their aides moving into, you know, these kinds of conversations on the Hill, that they would have taken a look at it. But, you know, it was blatantly obvious based on how they were interrogating Zuckerberg that they didn't have the least idea. One of the great examples of that was somebody asked the question, if somebody is not on the Facebook site, are they still being tracked by Facebook? And his response, which I'll have to talk to my people and get back to you. Now, anybody who's read anything about Facebook knows that if there's the Facebook icon on a website and you have not logged out of Facebook, that Facebook has access to your information. So if I know that, I assure you Mark Zuckerberg knows that. And he just tried to bamboozle the folks at the Senate by saying, I'll have to talk to my people and get back to you. Oh, please.
So time for Zuckerberg to be brought back in front of Congress, and this time maybe with some better informed lawmakers present. Some people have suggested that Facebook has now gotten so big that it really should be considered part of the commons, that it really should be turned into a public company.
That conversation has been had about Twitter as well. Yeah. And I think that it is the case. This is too much power in one person's hands, and not for nothing. But, you know, this is a young white male. You know, when he finally had a baby, it was like, oh, brave new world. People have children. I have to worry about what happens to kids. Well, I don't want to have to wait until Mark Zuckerberg has some other life experiences to realize the consequences that Facebook is having for people around the planet.
Ready to make it, don't care what the weather, don't care about no trouble, got myself. get together. I've been the kind of protection that's all around. I come up home, baby. I've been for real, baby, with the trouble man. Only three things for sure: taxes, debt, and trouble. Oh, this I know, baby. This I know, baby. Ain't gonna let it sweat me, baby. Come up hard, babe. Now I'm fine. Check the trouble to her. Hey, moving down the line.
Here is the latest shocking headline in this age of climate change. Antarctica losing 6 times more ice mass annually now than 40 years ago. To explain the breaking science, we are joined by Dr. Eric Rigneault, Chair of Earth System Science at University of California, Irvine, and Senior Research Scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Eric Rigneault, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Just 10 years ago, we were told, don't worry about Antarctica. Sea ice there was actually expanding. We thought snow was piling up deeper in the interior of the continent. How did we get from there to your new results published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences?
10 years ago, we had already indications that some significant changes were taking place in the Antarctic. I think the light turned on about this the mid-1990s, but it took more time to collect more data and understand what we were seeing better in order to come to a firmer conclusion. What you mentioned in terms of snowfall accumulation in the interior relates to old climate models that represented Antarctica as a sort of a sluggish mass, only responding to change in snowfall, which were predicted to increase because of increased evaporation of the surrounding warmer ocean. What we found in the last 20-plus years is that the glaciers draining the ice from the Antarctic continent are responding to climate forcing. They're responding in a stronger way, and in a slightly different way than what was anticipated.
And in 2014, you and your team said that some of the melting in a section of West Antarctic ice sheet was, quote, unstoppable. Can we now say that about other parts of Antarctica?
One of the highlights of this study is that there are other parts of Antarctica, especially in East Antarctica, that seem to be vulnerable and are changing slowly right now and hold more sea level rise potential than the West Antarctic part that is slowly falling apart right now. So it's sort of suggesting that more of the Antarctic continent is at stake than what we thought some years ago.
At the other pole of the Earth, Eric, the Arctic has been abnormally, unbelievably hotter. Has the same thing happened in Antarctica, and is that the cause of the increasing rate of ice loss there?
Both Greenland and Antarctica are actually mostly reacting to a change in ocean heat along the periphery of the island or the continent. In addition, in Greenland, of course, we have very warm air temperature that increased the melt of the ice sheet. In the Antarctic, the air temperature has not risen to the point where we melt the snow and ice. And in fact, Antarctica as a whole has not been warming up as fast as the rest of the world, whereas Greenland has been warming at 2 to 3 times the rest of the world. So situations are a little bit different, but the processes that are conducive to the disappearance of the land ice are similar. They are related to more warm ocean waters in contact with the ice sheet. So what's happening in the Antarctic is that the wind regime around the Antarctic, the westerlies that circulate clockwise around the Antarctic, if you're looking at South Pole, have increased in strength over time and markedly since the 1980s. They do that because Antarctica has not been warming up as fast as the rest of the world. So the temperature difference between Antarctica and the warming world has increased, and that results in stronger winds circulating around the continent. So not only these winds are getting stronger, they're contracting towards South Pole. And as a result of the Coriolis force, these winds tend to push the surface waters to the north, which in part explains the slight expanse of the sea ice. And to compensate for that, they push the subsurface waters to the south. And in the polar regions, the heat is not at the surface, it's below the surface, several hundred meters, where the water is warmer and saltier. That's why it's stable there. And that salty and warm water is able to melt the glaciers around the Antarctic much faster than it did in the past. And that is conducive to the glaciers accelerating into the sea because they feel less resistance to flow when they come to the coastline. Some of the plugs in front of them have been removed by the ocean, and they are able to flow slightly faster.
And your paper mentions the ozone hole as a contributing factor. Why is that?
Strangely, the ozone is also a participant. The disappearance of the ozone layer is resulting in a cooling of the stratosphere in the Antarctic because you don't have as much interaction between the ozone and incoming UV radiations from the sun. So that contributes also to the fact that the Antarctic is not warming up as fast as the rest of the world. Another factor that we should not forget about is that the snow fields, the snow cover in the Arctic is reducing very rapidly. The sea ice, as we know, has been reduced in a spectacular fashion. So as a result, we're replacing a very highly reflective surface in the Arctic by something that absorbs the solar radiation more. And as a result, the Arctic is warming a lot faster than the rest of the world. In the Antarctic, we don't have that. The Antarctic continent is almost as vast as before. The snow is not melting. The sea ice has not been retreating very rapidly. So in terms of the radiation budget, how much heat is absorbed by the Antarctic from the sun, there's been very little change compared to what's happening in the Arctic.
We don't get a lot of news from Antarctica, but when we do, it's often about huge ice shelves falling off West Antarctica, like the Larsen B many, many years ago. Are those really important events?
Yeah, they are very significant events, especially the Larsen B event that you mentioned, because prior to this event, there was still a little bit of debate in the community as to whether this floating extension played any role in buttressing, in holding back all the land ice from the Antarctic from spilling out into the ocean. So when we saw the breakup of Larsen B, we looked at the glaciers upstream of that ice shelf to figure out whether they would speed up or not. And not only they sped up, they accelerated by a factor 3 to 8 in a very short-term period. And we are now 17 years later, and these glaciers are still flowing 3 to 5 times above their prior speed, which shows that the change in that part of Antarctica was irreversible and unstoppable.
So West Antarctica is the sort of point that heads up towards Chile and Argentina. But the large part of the continent is East Antarctica. Have you more to report in this new paper about that part of the South Pole?
The traditional view on East Antarctica, which is, as you said, the largest share of the Antarctic continent, is that it sits higher. It's higher in elevation. It sits on bedrock that, for the most part, is above sea level, whereas West Antarctica is grounded on bedrock below sea level. That's why we call it a marine ice sheet. Prevailing view on East Antarctica is that it's not vulnerable to change. It's as cold as can be, and nothing can perturb it. Most of the changes that we see in East Antarctica, however, are along the coastline. And as I said earlier, the surrounding ocean plays a very important role in the evolution of these glaciers. And they are the sort of knobs that control how much of that ice in the East Antarctic plateau is able to spill out to the Southern Ocean. And we found that these knobs have a few leaks in them.
And after an exhaustive survey, you found in the 1990s, ice loss from Antarctica more than tripled from the previous decade, and it's gone up again every decade since. Is there a way to predict that rate of loss for the next few decades?
Well, that's sort of the ultimate goal of all these studies, besides detailing exactly what's happening to the polar regions and understanding the physical processes that control the evolution of the ice. We want to put that new knowledge, new understanding of the evolution of the ice into numerical models, sophisticated models that include not only the ice, but the surrounding ocean, the atmosphere, the winds, so that we can make more reliable projection of sea level in the future. So right now, the projection that we have, I would call rather primitive, because they don't include all the key components. And they are also conservative because they do not represent the vector of very rapid changes in the Antarctic, which are the glaciers. And most of what we're seeing today says that the glaciers are the vector of the mass change in the Antarctic. So until we have a very reliable description of what they do in these models, the projection of sea level rise from the Antarctic in the future should be called into question and be considered as conservative as to what may happen in the future. Now, as glaciologists, we don't want to tell the public what a conservative scenario might be. We would like to be able to inform them about the worst-case scenario, because in the case of sea level, you just want to know how bad things can be rather than some middle-range raise of sea level.
And do you have a guesstimate on what that might be by the year 2100? How much will we get?
Well, we are right now, if we look at the rate of increase of the mass loss from Greenland, from Antarctica, and from all the mountain glaciers around the world, and if we add up the thermal expansion from the ocean, we are on a pace that is going to take us to 1 meter sea level rise by 2100. It is likely that the pace of decay of the polar regions will probably get higher than that. We've only seen sort of the beginning of the decay of the polar regions. But that also depends on what we do with our climate system. Not the whole history of the 21st century is written in stone yet. The next 20, 30 years are probably written in stone. But what's going to happen after that depends also on how we control climate warming.
Eric, what will you be working on next?
We continue our work in Greenland. I think my main focus in the coming years is to gather more data around the Antarctic, and especially in East Antarctica, so we can make timely and solid progress in constraining the evolution of this part of Antarctica, so we can put that knowledge in models and improve the reliability of these models at projecting what's going to happen in the coming decades. This way, the policymakers will have more solid data in hand to make the right decision for our future. In the meantime, I'm still keen to convey the information we gather to the general public so that they stay informed of what's going on right now and hopefully appreciate that we have a serious problem in the polar regions that's going to affect all of us.
Come on! Listen! Listen!
Theater, see it all pop in real life. Corrupt invading your city, beach of black and blue. Might wanna inform your city, the beast is on the move. Might need to protect your life, when it's either them or you. Fight!
People give to you your power, your gun, your shield, your hours. Represent them, civilians and citizens are not to be abused.
And everything they tell you may not really be the truth.
They use a gun today, back in the day they used a goose.
Nowadays the po-po needs so little proof. Damage, property, terrorized families with a rude attitude. No apology, no avenues to pursue. Wrongdoers who have done the wrong unto you.
To serve and protect, but what about who? Be inspecting and checking you, is it man or God's rule? Spill is wrecking with evidence, still the planet's all full. So I'm beckoning and reckon we need to manage y'all. You know the rules. This is the
many know and see the beast with donation, taking advantage of his post and station. Turn peacekeeping into an aggressive operation. Says you need to take a permanent vacation.
Many shouldn't even have chosen this occupation. Devils pose as angels, walk the beat faking. Take away my earth like they was gon' waste it. Took it to the head like heads stuck to they stairs. Working for the devil in hell, they hate agents. Someone check the wiring, it's glitches in the matrix.
The people give to you your power, your gun, your shield.
Causing people dismay.
We got terror, corruption, guns, AIDS.
Now I gotta dodge public servants with 12 gauges. Otherwise they gon' lock me up in a cage. Like I'm some wild animal treated like a slave.
Pulling they holes and bailing they hate. Speech freedom, supposedly just watch what you say. Cause the truth will hurt them even though the truth ain't hate. Retaliation with the vengeance on this holy state.
All popping real life. Corrupt invading your city, beat your black and blue. Might wanna inform the city the beast is on the move. Might need to protect yourself when it's either them or you.
Fire people give to you your power, your gun, your shield, your salary. Represent the truth. Civilians and citizens are not to be abused.
And everything they tell us really may not be the truth. They use a gun today, back in the days they use a noose.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, it's so great to have you here. We know that your time is in high demand, and you've already had such a busy week. I saw you on Monday having that discussion with Ta-Nehisi Coates at Riverside Church in commemoration of Dr. King. That night you jetted off, and you went on the late night show with Colbert, where I hear you cursed out the entire country.
Oh, yeah, apparently.
And this morning I saw on Instagram stories that you had a Democratic caucus meeting, and you were explaining to your followers exactly what it meant and the way that you do in what is one of the only remaining civics classes, I think, that's left in the country. So I just want to start by asking you, like, how are you feeling right now?
Most days, I have no idea what day it is. And people are like, have a good weekend. And I'm like, what? So
would it be fair to say that some of the cooking that happens on Instagram Live is a necessity because you just have to multitask?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It definitely is. It's a total necessity. And I figured it's also a good way to use technology to reach constituents, because sometimes it's just physically almost impossible with demands in our time. So we have to figure out ways to kind of use the small pockets of time that we do have creatively, even if it's just when I'm prepping vegetables for dinner. If I can get a conversation about policy in there, it's tremendously effective.
That might be like a 200 level or a 300 level social media course.
Yeah.
Or something. You taught a kind of Twitter for Dummies class.
I wouldn't say dummies.
Twitter for members of Congress, which is kind of synonymous. How'd that go?
It went really well. This one was more of a rapid fire. So this session was really a panel, and it was myself, it was Ted Lieu, who himself has a very large Twitter following, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, as well as some of the Twitter government kind of outreach folks at Twitter itself. And actually, House Ethics was there, because there are House Ethics rules based on what you can tweet, when you can tweet it. And so they kind of covered the ethics side. And I kind of covered just my approach and how we can better get a party message to really resonate with people.
As you went from kind of an obscure candidate to then much less obscure candidate, but still not global celebrity, then go to Democratic nominee, then go to Democratic congresswoman, each moment you kind of ratchet up in the amount of public attention that you're getting. Did you ever notice yourself kind of self-censoring a little bit or thinking an extra beat? And how did you deal with that, or did you not?
For me, the most stressful time was right after the primary, because that, I think, was the biggest, starkest difference in my life. Like, literally overnight, I went from no one caring who I was unless I was swiping my Metro card too slow to, like, everyone being like, who is she? What is this? All these cameras all over the place. And it was just a completely alien change. I was extremely stressed out because it felt like everything I said had so much more weight overnight. A couple of days after the primary, I was in my neighborhood and I turned around this corner to get on the street, and this woman saw me and just started crying. Like, she just broke down crying.
Wow.
And even though I didn't feel like a different person, I felt this immense responsibility of all of these people's hopes and dreams for our future. It is something that I grapple with a lot, because I know it's not me. It's like this avatar of me, but I still feel a responsibility to do the best that I can.
Can you think of any examples of where your kind of antenna was tuned to, like, a public reaction to a particular thing? Did you, like, notice, like, oh, wow, Green New Deal is, like, really popping now? Like, people are really hungry for this?
It started off unintentionally, but I feel like I end up listening to things in that I'll tweet something, and something that gets particularly extra traction, I kind of dissect, especially if I didn't expect it to build traction. And I'm like, And it was a similar thing actually with the Green New Deal, is that we were floating this as a policy discussion before even the general election. And what we found was that we were interviewing policy experts and academics and activists and advocates about this. And we weren't even sure if we wanted to call it a Green New Deal. I wasn't 1,000% sure on that kind of branding, if you will, or how we would talk about that. And what we found was that it was kind of a working title. Green New Deal was a working title. And we were almost had the understanding that it was going to be called something else. But it kept, like, leaking and catching. And people just started writing articles calling it a Green New Deal before we even called it that ourselves. And so because of that, that was in a moment where I was listening. And it was like, okay, let's not try to force our own thing on this. If this is building traction, if it's easily being communicated, then let's just run with it.
One thing I noticed after the election, in that kind of fraught moment where you were kind of proving yourself to the country, you really leaned into it. You basically took all comers and you were hitting on all of the strides. And then you did the one, I forget what the exact quote was. It was some misstep about Israel.
Oh, yeah, the firing line, which then got doctored. And then the doctored video is the one that made it on Fox News.
Right.
And then, like, everyone just sees the doctored version instead of the actual exchange.
It did feel like you stepped back a little bit.
There were a couple of things happening in that moment. One is that everyone in the world thought that my general election was a sure thing, except me. I did not think that my win in the general was a sure thing.
I didn't either.
Yeah, we talked about it.
It might have been two people.
I did not. And, like, everyone around me was like, you're crazy. Like, it's going to be a landslide. And I was like, no, it's not. Before that interview even happened, I had already agreed that that was going to be my last one. And it just ended up ending on a bad note.
After you won the nomination, your mansion in Yorktown was uncovered.
My two-bedroom mansion.
And that had actually been part of our coverage of the race and had been part of your story the entire time. But it did involve foreclosure. It involved surrogates court. So what was your experience with the banks with foreclosure?
Well, I feel like For me, I was largely shielded from direct interactions with the bank because at that time when my father passed, I was just around 18 years old. And this was, you know, we were confronting the double whammy, as you already reported on, of us struggling with our payments in the middle of a financial crisis, but also losing my father, who was the main breadwinner in our home. I remember being at the house, and there would be these cars that started pulling up and taking pictures of our house. They were just anticipating something happening. And so, and my mom would walk up to them and be like, what are you doing? And they basically say, well, we're taking photos from the street. You can't really tell us what to do. And it was just very deeply unsettling. That's when these predatory practices that we knew banks engaged in leapt off the page, leapt off the television, and it was literally on the street in front of my house.
And it's not just what banks do, it's often what they don't do, which follow the law when it comes to modifications or refinancing or just work with people. So you're now going to be in a position to regulate those banks. Banks were unwilling to work with you a couple years ago. Now they're going to have to work with you.
Very early after I won my primary, there was a lot of outreach from incumbent Democrats. And the one question that everyone kept asking was, what committee do you want to be on? What committee do you want to be on? And I literally had just gotten elected. And I'm like, I don't know. What committees are there? And they do change in name from one administration, one majority to another. And everyone was so immediate in that one question, not how are you doing? How are you coping? Right. Hey, you came out of nowhere. You know, it was what committee do you want to be on? And I remember thinking, wow, like, why is this the question? And I spent one day in D.C. and I met with some folks. And it wasn't until like the very end of the day that I was told, well, you know, if you want a good committee, you got to raise funds. Because at that time, I had raised funds for other progressive candidates. I had driven folks to their donation links and things like that. And so by that time, we had raised over, you know, I think $50,000 or $100,000 for other progressive non-corporate funded campaigns. And I was like, oh, I am raising funds. And they're like, oh, no, 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 to, you know, the D-Trip. And I was like, oh, but I had just gone through this year where at the time, the D-Trip had gone against other progressive candidates. And I was like, okay, well, I remember leading that. And I'm like, well, I'm going to get put on some terrible committee. And so election time comes, and we're just getting our committee assignments this week. So it's January of the new term. But we've basically spent the last 3 months since Election Day lobbying. And it's this very opaque process. No one gives you a sheet of paper and says, like, this is how you get on a committee. And so a lot of freshmen are just kind of babes in the woods, like, how do I do this? And you just talk to a lot of people. But one of the interesting developments on financial services is because we were asking to be put on an exclusive committee, and financial services is an exclusive committee. And for a freshman, that does not normally happen. And then we started feeling like we're feeling much more reception to this request than we had anticipated. We're like, what's going on? And I had sat down with Chairman Waters. I had spoken with a lot of other members. And it seems like we're in this very interesting moment where after the financial crisis, all these activists and advocates really started zeroing in on the Financial Services Committee. And because its members were getting so much more scrutiny than they had in the past, it no longer became the same kind of fundraising committee because those members were getting targeted a lot. And so as a result, even incumbent members that were on it have left the committee to go to other money committees. And so it's opened up this huge window. And so this year, the Financial Services Committee has actually been staffed with a lot of progressives on it to kind of occupy that space. And in fact, frontline members, it's seen as too difficult of an assignment. Like on judiciary, you'll have too many tough votes.
There seems to be this division between candidates where identity is being emphasized and candidates where policy is being emphasized. And I think that what a lot of people are really attracted to about you is that you're a representative now who is able to merge the two in a way that fulfills a lot of people's interests. So I'm curious about you. There's been a lot of talk of litmus tests. Mm-hmm. People put a lot of different things in their litmus tests. What are you looking for in an emerging 2020 candidate? What are your priorities?
So I think that oftentimes policy and progressivism gets pitted against identity in a lot of different ways, and it just like makes a mess. For me, I think it's important on one side, for the progressive side, to not ignore the power of identity, because I know when I was running my race in the very beginning, I was running with a very strong progressive base and a very strong progressive coalition. But that alone was not enough to take me over the top. Mm-hmm. And it was when I really leaned in on this broader message and crafted a progressive message that was rooted in my life story, that we were able to really capture a much wider electorate, even though my progressive message was still the same. And so I think it's important that we don't ignore the power of identity, because it is very powerful, especially for women, especially for the rage of women right now. It is, Rebecca Traister has written about this. It's mm-hmm. like women's rage is a very potent political force, and it changes things on the right and the left. You know, it was primarily these women back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. It was primarily these white women who were supporting the Ku Klux Klan that got all of these statues erected in the South that are being taken down today that people think were erected around the time of the Civil War. It's a very potent political force on both sides of the aisle. And so I think it's something that we shouldn't ignore. I think it's great that we have multiple female presidential candidates, so there's not the woman running. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh my God, you know? So I'm very excited about there being multiple women that can represent different parts of the political spectrum mm-hmm. on the left. So that's something that I'm thankful for, because it means that we don't get boxed in as one belief. And so I think that's really good. I do not think that for the future of humanity and for our country to continue to prosper, that we cannot have another presidential cycle where climate change is not being asked about at almost every debate. And that includes the role of fossil fuel industries, and that includes the role of a broad spectrum of issues.
So one thing that was really interesting in the whole Martin Luther King Day event on Monday, this is an event that is honoring Martin Luther King, a civil rights hero. It's predominantly African-American audience and speakers and, you know, movement leaders who were there. Mm-hmm. And my impression of the event was that the politics being espoused were much more to the left of what we normally hear out of mainstream Democrats. Mm-hmm. And that is in direct contrast with the message we constantly hear about what the Black community really wants. Yeah. And the idea that progressivism and people of color are in two different buckets and need to be catered to in these two very different ways.
Yeah, which I find funny, because the polling and all of the data and everything that we feel and see shows that the opposite is true, is that communities of color are usually much further to the left than white liberals, because racism, colonialism, we understand through lived experience in a way that many don't understand, that these are issues that are part of a hyper-capitalist framework. You know, Black folks are descendants of slaves that were imported, quote unquote, by slave owners to the United States for the explicit purpose of cultivating crops. And it was predicated on white supremacy and racial superiority, but we have to understand that white supremacy exists for a reason. And they exist for very specific cultural and economic reasons. And LBJ talked about this. Like, if you can convince a poor white man that he's superior to a Black man, he'll empty his pockets for you. And so it's not just economic reasons why racism exists, but there are economic reasons why racism is perpetuated and incentivized, whether that's housing, income, etc. Like I said on Monday with Ta-Nehisi, until America tells the truth about itself, we're never going to heal. It's like this thing that as a culture we hide, we make excuses for, we do the economic anxiety thing when Trump wins. It's like this big wound with a big ugly scab on it, and it's just going to stay this itchy thing that we keep going back to until we just deal with it.
I think the part that is interesting to me is certain people have appropriated the idea that we have to acknowledge and deal with a problem, which I think is right, as a kind of a be-all, end-all. And I think that some of my political concerns is that there is this kind of space in the Democratic Party that says, you know, if I stand on a stage and I say the word intersectionality, if mm-hmm. I stand on the stage and say, you know, we have to address these issues and racism is real, then everybody applauds
And there's not necessarily kind of the policy follow-up that's necessary to start to address those root causes.
If you've never experienced different treatment in your life, you wouldn't know what different treatment feels like or looks like. Every single person in this country can acknowledge some privilege of some type. You
right.
know, I'm a cisgendered woman. I will never know the trauma of feeling like I'm not born in the right body. Mm-hmm. And that is a privilege that I have mm-hmm. no matter how poor our family was when I was born. But it's really hard for some people to admit. It's part of this weird American dream mythology that we have that in a lot of circumstances isn't as true or isn't as clearly communicated as we'd like for it to be or yeah. we wish it was.
Yeah, I'm working on it. Maybe next piece on privileged dialogues and how to make it more constructive. Thank you so much for coming and spending the time with us and getting into all of these subjects. We hope to have similar conversations with you in the future.
Yeah, totally. This is great. Thank you.
I give them my votes, then I give me democracy. Business not the priority instead of the working majority. I give them my votes and them abuse it. New government, new excuses. You promise to give me peace and you give me war. You promise me justice and only jail the poor. You promise jobs and you close the factory, but there's always work in the penitentiary. Ah, yeah, yeah. Politicians come, they come from the left, they come from the right. Every few years politicians come, some come from the right, some come from the left. They come with them party and them media, with them same lies and promises. They come with them slogan and them speeches, with them same words and policies. They come with their politics of hate, yeah, and they come divide us. They come with their politics of fear, and they come divide us. Again and again and again with the votes and my government all over the world them give us. New name for government. The director, not the president. Not the new name for government. The manager, not the minister. Not the new name for government. The Senate, not the legal department. Not the new name for government. Army man, a gate man. The new name for government. Hey. Terminana. Terminana. Yeah. Terminana. Terminana. Na, 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 na. Now, why they not see the students protesting? Saying where the votes we give for education. Now why they no see the workers protesting? Yeah. Saying we no vote to lose we occupation. I said they no see the hungry and they no see the sick. They no see we suffering and they no see the weak. Ah, yeah, body bar. I give them my votes, but they no give me democracy. Business not the priority instead of the working majority. I give them my vote and them abuse it. New government, new excuses. You promise to give me peace and you give me war. You promise me justice and only jail the poor. You promise jobs and you close the factory, but there's always work in the penitentiary for my people, yeah, yeah.
Give me my vote.
Yes, we take it back the government. And we give it to the people.
Give me my vote.
Yes, we take it back the presidency.
Give me my vote.
And we give it to the people.
Give me my vote.
Well, we take it back the rights.
Give me my vote.
And we give it to the people.
Give me my vote.
And we take it back the senate.
Give me my vote.
And we give it to the people.
Give me my vote.
Well, we take it back the law.
Give me my vote.
And we give it to the people.
Give me my vote.
Yes, we take it back the power.
Give me my vote. Give me my vote. Give me my vote.
then they give me democracy. Business not the priority, instead of the working majority. I give them my votes and them abuse it. New government, new excuses. Promise to give me peace and you give me war. You promise me justice and only jail the poor of my people. Promise jobs and you close the factory. But there's always work in the penitentiary.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
From Berkeley, it's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
Program is TwitWit Radio. In this episode, the connected internet of things, multiple personality disorder, fact or fiction, and hybrid humans, half god or half ass. Baron has his hand up.
I have an announcement.
Go ahead.
Multiple personality disorder is not a disorder. It's a complex.
Siri, change disorder to complex.
Multiple personality complex. Would you like to watch it now?
Is it a mystery?
Mystery religions post-rapture, Revelations 13, the mark of the beast.
Is it Armageddon or Armorpocalypse?
C, goddess, cult, Ishtar, queen of Babylon.
Babylon is a great property. Jared has his eye on it.
Greater Israel is getting a makeover.
Swing voter has the floor.
Is Greater Israel, greater than what?
Greater than the King David Hotel.
We are talking with Melania, Ivanka, and Baron about a recent discovery. Future ruins have been found in Greater Israel.
The embassy is moving to Jerusalem against many loud voices.
Moving the embassy to Jerusalem will lead to war, Ivanka.
Oh, do you think so?
Monotheism is unsustainable, dude. I have a question for Baron.
I can try.
Okay, in a wrestling match between the Queen of Babylon and King David, who wins?
Now, think carefully.
Can you repeat the question?
The Queen of Babylon versus King David. Who wins?
Ishtar. No, David. Queen of...
Wrong.
Round two. Ancient data storage for 200 points.
The world's first hard disk storage device.
Would you repeat the question?
World's first hard disk storage device.
The pyramids of Gaza.
Wrong. Oh.
Clay tablets.
Wronger.
Clay tablets.
We have a winner.
I challenge the ruling of the chair.
On what basis?
I gave the correct answer first.
In Holy Scripture, and I quote, "Who shall be among the first shall be last. Who shall be among the last shall be first."
Where does it say that?
It's in the bylaws, dude.
Is there a second?
Oh, second.
The motion has a second. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
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 The motion passes. Next item is the Holy Land theme park.
The Holy Land we have now is great, but it could be greater. It could be Greater Israel.
Marduk will be pleased.
Marduk?
Yeah, Marduk is an evil Babylonian demon god.
When I was a little girl in Slovenia, I had a vision of the Queen of Babylon. She inspired me to imitate the goddess Ishtar.
I saw that movie. Ishtar was a box office flop.
Ishtar has terrible press.
But I love the whore of Babylon.
Ishtar is sacred high priestess, not whore.
In ancient Babylon, prostitutes had equal rights as men due to their control over the region's birth canals.
Leslie Gore, I'm Berkeley Kidd. This is Twit Wit Radio, half true, more or less 100% of the time.
I call the question.
The question has been called.
I object.
It's not debatable.
What is the question?
We can sell the property to Disney or declare bankruptcy and sell off the attractions. Tomorrowland is worth a fortune.
Judeo-Christianity is not sustainable.
Discussion?
Imagine this, a new and improved Holy Land theme park and hotel casino.
With a Dead Sea water slide for Baron.
I hate Dead Sea water slides.
Would you like to see the plans?
The Holy Land theme park will be great.
When visitors enter the park, they get a chip implanted under their skin and a surveillance collar, so you never have to worry about getting lost.
In the new and improved Holy Land theme park, getting lost in the crowd is a capital offense, apparently.
You said the rides are free?
Admission fees are billed to your account.
Baron has a barcode tattooed on his bottom.
I washed it off.
Is the Holy Land theme park interactive?
The whole family can stone a prostitute on Sunday afternoon.
I find that deeply offensive.
It's just business.
If you sell the property to Disney, there will be persecutions and religious war for another 5,000 years. It'll worsen the refugee problem.
The refugees can find work in the Holy Land luxury hotel and casino.
You know, that's fantasy, landlady.
At the Holy Land theme park, the people can kill each other all day long and then go to bed after a warm shower.
Are there any joy rides?
That's a great idea. The Rapture ride.
The Rapture is not really a Judeo-Christian concept.
Ivanka, is the Rapture in the Bible?
Good idea.
And there will be a contest, a Beauty and the Beast contest, with sexy beasts and beauty queens competing for cash prizes.
And a kissing booth for mortal sin-making on date night.
You will love it.
I'm falling in love with you, Melania.
I am Ishtar, Queen of Babylon.
Change into wine with headless horses, merry-go-round. No fears of obscurity, God's own security. A theme park with a room for you if you've got the wages of sin. Wear a burqa and they let you in for free. Would you like a simple camel ride? Or maybe you'd rather be crucified? Your crown of thorns you can wear here with pride. Our Holy Land is raking it in. A theme will part with a room for you if you've got the wages of sin.
Visitors to the Holy Land theme park get a free wireless dog collar. Good for all the attractions.
Then the holy gates swing open and the fun begins.
Then what happens?
You select a cult and get baptized on the holy water board slide.
Oh, and even atheists will like that.
But maybe not the first time.
I'm talking with the principal founders of a new Kickstarter project, Holy Land Theme Park.
It's a safe place for endless holy war enjoyment.
Why haven't you been prosecuted for war crimes?
For what?
Fact check, is the Holy Land Theme Park a scam?
Technically, compassionate torture on stuffed camels is not a war crime.
All the gods are represented.
Pagan gods, guitar gods, whatever you want.
Any atheist attractions?
Oh, yes, yes. I am an ancient atheist priestess.
Oh, come on, who's going to believe that?
Yoko Ono is my spirit guide.
He can burn in hell.
Radio.
The voice is Kenneth McGee. I'm Berkeley Kidd. This is Twit Wit Radio.
Do you worship Ishtar?
She is Ishtar, dude. So, Baron, what are you going to do when you grow up?
I'm going to start my own religion.
Keep talking.
It's called Baronology. Do you want to join?
I don't believe in Baronology. It's a fake religion.
Is not.
Is too.
Baronology is real, dude.
Baron, be nice to the Judeo-Christians. We are eating them for dinner.
Human sacrifice is not allowed in civilized countries.
Civilized people have no taste.
Cannibalism is unethical.
I can eat anyone I want to eat. Very religious person, but what do I have to do to become a member?
I don't know. I'm just the mascot.
Baronology is like Scientology, but with more surveillance and fewer audits.
Why does anyone believe this crap? You are getting on my nerves, Alex. Do you believe in anything?
Baronology is a con. It's a big scam.
But it might be good for my skin.
Oh, I like it.
Ishtar will be pleased.
Baron, are you an accredited baronologist?
I am, but I can't save your skin.
Then what good are you, Baron?
Can I ask you a question?
No.
Is your new religion a scam like Scientology, or is it a scam like Christianity?
Baronology is transhuman, dude.
Baron is a secret experimental hybrid transhuman invented by the military to bamboozle the public mind.
Cool.
Part human, part software. Baron is many things.
Like what?
I have bulletproof skin.
Really? Bulletproof skin is not normal.
Of course, Baron is not normal. Normal is the enemy of the great.
He has great genes, just like his mother.
What about his father's genes? How defective are you, boy?
My mother is descended from Ishtar, a Babylonian beauty queen.
Baron has the royal blood of Ishtar in his veins. He is a savior god.
I don't want to be a savior god.
Well, what do you want to be?
It's in your contract, Baron.
Ivanka, be nice to your half-brother. He has a high IQ for a boy.
What is your IQ, Baron?
148.
Are you a genius?
So what?
Baron exaggerates his mental ability like his father.
Baron, is your father a genius?
How would I know?
We are very smart people.
I speak 5 languages simultaneously, but nobody understands.
And I'm going to be the first woman president.
What am I going to be?
You can be great Babylonian queen, too. Put some lipstick on your wicked stepsister.
Be very careful, Baron. The Babylonians were into child sacrifice.
I don't want to die.
All savior gods die. Why not you?
But why?
To be reborn again and again under a full moon.
At Bohemian Grove.
Why has my father forsaken me?
We all die alone.
I don't want to die alone.
Stop whining about it.
I get nosebleeds.
Is there a history of human sacrifice in the family?
I do not reveal the secret of my success.
Human sacrifice is a time-honored tradition practiced by priests, bishops, and popes.
And some nuns, too.
What happened to you?
Well, there was that one time when Sister Teresa poured hot candle wax on my ass.
Did you report her to the Pope?
I tried to, but angry nuns carry lethal weapons under those outfits.
What happened?
Well, I was taken to the church and ritually abused.
Can you name names?
No. Look what happened to Princess Diana.
Diana was flirting with a foreign bloodline.
But I'm your only child.
You will not feel a thing.
I don't want to die.
It is an honor to be sacrificed.
You people are crazy.
Is this a call for help?
Help!
Sit, Baron. Sit.
Don't hurt him.
Ouch!
Baron, do not bite your mother.
Baron!
Die, die, die!
Ivanka wants to kill me.
Oh, poor baby. Is Baron not getting his needs met?
I'm not getting my needs met.
You are getting on my nerves, Baron. Do you see me crying like a squealing pig? I have unmet needs, too. We all do.
Not me. I've never had an unmet need.
We were talking about child sacrifice in Judeo-Christian families.
It's totally satanic, dude.
We are talking about the paternity of Melania's only child.
I have a right to know who my father is.
Will somebody shut him up?
Is Steve Bannon my natural father?
We are ruled by powers greater than ourselves.
That's disgusting. Why did you let him near you?
I never let him kiss me.
Should I tell him or you?
You also have a twin brother. I don't know what happened to him.
He's being harvested for spare body parts and DNA experiments, so you can live forever.
Why wasn't I told?
It's better you don't know. You might need a heart transplant someday.
What is his name?
I can't remember. Ivanka, do you recall the name of Baron's twin brother?
Number 666.
I remember now. I can see his face whenever I look at you, Baron. Show some pity for a mother's lost child.
I can't believe you let a creep like Steve Bannon in the same bed with you.
It's disgusting just to imagine it.
Why did you do that?
It was Daddy's idea.
Is that true?
Donald wanted to watch.
And now, back to our story.
May I go now?
Where are you going, Baron?
I have a staff meeting.
Baron has a staff?
I have a lot on my plate.
What are you and your staff working on?
My TED Talk.
What is your TED Talk about?
Babylonian small change agents.
I'm teaching Baron everything I know about counter-surveillance systems. How much does it pay?
Are you still hiring?
It's just a startup company.
Where are you getting your funding?
The Mossad. I'm not supposed to tell anyone.
The Mossad neither confirms nor denies the corruption of man-boy billionaires.
Is Ivanka a spokesperson for the Mossad?
Sorry, I'm expecting a call.
Caller on line one.
Am I on the air?
Go ahead.
I'm being held at a secret location inside a riddle and wrapped in a puzzle. Can I talk to my twin brother, please?
You sound like Baron, but I need proof. Do you know your mother's maiden name?
Do you remember your first pet?
Who was your favorite teacher?
I was kidnapped at birth. I only know my number.
Do you have the mark of the beast on your body?
Maybe. What does it look like?
Why do you want to know?
I need a new kidney. Ask Baron if I can borrow one of his kidneys.
Baron is very busy. Do you have a number where you can be reached?
You know my number.
How much are we talking about?
Hello? Hello?
Agent 666 hung up. Call him back. I've got an extra kidney I can put on the market.
Was it something I said?
Is that even legal?
Baron, your long-lost twin brother needs you.
What does he want from me?
Everything you have ever wanted.
How can I contact him?
Well, first we track a recognizable fact pattern from his internet searches, and then we remotely simulate a counter-surveillance response to his blockchain activities prior to detection.
Marcom will be pleased.
Marcom?
What's Marcom?
Marketing and communications.
Baronology is the next big thing.
Baronology has peaked. Dump the stock and declare bankruptcy or sell off the assets now. Fast. We can't wait.
So, Baronology is a scam.
Are you a con artist like your father?
Why would I lie to you?
Because it's good for business?
Oh, yeah, I'm learning how to do that.
Tell me something I don't know.
Nothing is real. Kim Jong-un is a crisis actor.
Is everything fake?
No, everything is scripted. We have real storyboard meetings.
How does this movie end?
It'll probably be another surprise attack by one of our allies.
Oh, please stop. I'm tired of the infighting.
How much is it worth to you?
All my jewelry, my divorce settlement, my kidneys. You can have it all. I can't live like this.
You already collected your divorce settlement.
I have a great deal. $100,000 for each porn star.
Oh, that can add up over time.
Can you estimate how much that might be?
Sign here at the bottom.
What does it say?
It says, no more settlements.
Don't sign it.
I'm not signing this.
Why not?
Donald must approve.
Prenuptial agreements can always be renegotiated.
Baron, try to focus. Sit up straight. Why are you staring off into space?
I'm casting a magic spell to free us from a cruel and wicked Donald.
The Donald?
When casting a magic spell to change the terms and conditions agreement, you must keep your eyes fixed on the target.
How do you know these things?
I was taught by Ishtar, the divine goddess of Venus, queen of heaven, sacred and profane goddess of war, and the bride of Marduk, the Babylonian demon god from hell.
Cool.
When I was a little girl in Slovenia, I lived in a big surveillance state. I had no privacy. The camera was always watching. The surveillance police took photographs of me on the runway and when I was napping at the beach. I have heard the wolf whistle.
How do you make a wolf whistle?
I hacked the passcode.
Is any of this true?
Can you keep a secret?
If I have to lie to you, I will.
Good. Lie to me.
Some tea?
Thank you. Tastes like truth serum.
500 mics.
I love the side effects.
My orders were to infiltrate the billionaire singles community and collect targeted sperm samples.
Oh, you go, girl.
But don't let them kiss you.
No kissing. Just a quick sperm sample and I'm out of here.
So all this time, Melania and Ivanka and Baron have been working as deep cover moles for covert intelligence?
You have said too much.
But which agencies are you working for? And are they hiring? I mean, if the benefit's any good, I might switch sides.
Who is behind this?
It started thousands of years ago in an ancient Bohemian Grove.
Bohemian Grove? Oh, dear.
Am I going to be sacrificed to an ancient Babylonian god at Bohemian Grove?
Don't worry about it, Baron. They have your twin brother, Agent 666.
What does that make me?
Rosemary's baby.
Marduk will be pleased.
Who is Marduk? Who is Marduk?
Marduk. Marduk is a boar. That's right. I hate demon gods.
What's going to happen to me?
Put your trust in Ishtar. She will protect you. Everyone, take a deep breath. Suck in your tummy and spread the other cheek.
Don't tell me what to do. This is the Berkeley Signal.